Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is Newsroom Robots, the podcast where we explore the intersection of artificial intelligence and the news industry. I'm Nikita Roy, data scientist, media entrepreneur, and one of the many founders currently building their ventures at the Harvard Innovation Labs. On the Newsroom Robots, I'm excited to bring you insightful conversations with industry experts about how AI is impacting the way we do journalism. Joining me on the show today is Florent Daudens. He's the Director of News Gathering and Deployment at Canada's national public broadcaster, Radio Canada, where he focuses on enhancing the news department with artificial intelligence. His work involves AI training and development in their newsroom, as well as managing operations across their national, parliamentary, and foreign bureaus. With a passion for AI and technology trends, he has contributed to the digital evolution of major Canadian media outlets for over 15 years. In this episode, we discuss the importance of AI literacy in newsrooms and the AI training program implemented at Radio Canada that helps journalists understand the basics of generative AI, including effective prompting techniques and ethical considerations when using AI in their work. Florent, welcome to Newsroom Robots.
Hi, Nikita. Thank you for inviting me to the podcast. I really enjoy listening to it, so it's an honor to be here.
Oh, thanks, Florent. I actually enjoy reading all of your LinkedIn posts on your insights on AI and journalism. And actually, although you write all of your posts in French, thanks to AI and LinkedIn's translation feature, I always translate it into English and read all of them because unfortunately, my French is not at the level where I'd like to be, where I can read fluently. But I always find all of your insights so valuable. And I'm actually really eager to get into that deeper today, to hear about your perspectives on AI, and especially with your role leading AI initiatives at Radio Canada, which is part of the French counterpart of CBC, which is Canada's national public broadcaster. And you focus mainly on the French-speaking audience in Canada. And your approach to enhancing AI literacy within your newsroom is something that caught my attention. And that's where I really like to start us off today, by discussing AI literacy, because upskilling newsrooms in AI is currently a huge focus for many, and I've been involved in similar efforts. So I'm very curious to hear about how have you at Radio Canada been helping all of your journalists, producers, editors to build the skills needed to harness AI, AI tools and insights?
Well, it's a good question, and it's really a question I'm passionate about. Developing AI literacy in the newsroom is really important for me. Briefly, Radio Canada is, you know, we have TV and radio stations. We also have digital platforms, a lot of TikTok accounts, and etc. And within all this, I work in news. So for the training initiatives at Radio Canada, actually, there are three different aspects. The first one is the creation of an expertise group. The second one is training for journalists and managers also on the basics of AI. And then an experimentation workshop. I would call it a sort of, orange belt level for AI. So the expertise group is really designed as a cross-functional group. We don't machine learning developers. There is also an analyst, people from other departments, and obviously journalists. There's a virtual component. We have a Google group where we can exchange news about AI, etc. And we meet in person every 2 weeks or three to brainstorm on coverage topics, share the latest developments in the field, and ongoing project. The second aspect is the training session. It's a three-hour block that is really, I would say, the starting point for us, the foundation of AI in our newsroom. We study what AI is and what it is not, because the goal is to demystify it. And then we get our hands dirty because we want to explore possible use cases and developing our prompt engineering skills. And it's fundamental for two reasons, because I think journalists need to know what they're talking about to properly inform the public afterward. And, to know the possibilities, to be able to imagine concrete use cases in their daily task. So at the end, it's a question of innovation development, because training is something extremely important for us. We want people to be able to embrace AI and not suffer from it, because if we don't know what we're talking about, if we don't know the possibilities, we will just miss the train and then realize that we have to use it, but we don't know how, and it's going to be scary, etc. So I think it's really important to be able to feel empowered and to know the limits of it also. And putting this tool in the hands of journalists is also a way for us to encourage them to experiment and to send the message that they can make mistakes too. They have to make mistakes with AI, because it's the starting point to learn, to develop our expertise. And, recently I was reading a Reuters Institute study about media training for AI. And I was really surprised, because only 10% of newsrooms train their journalists in AI. And I remember a comment you wrote on LinkedIn. Another stat was 13% of newsroom don't even think about it, don't even consider training the journalist in AI. And I must say, it's something I don't understand, but I guess everybody has good reasons.
I think the point that you brought up over there is we need to embrace it, because if we don't, we'll finally realize that AI has become a part of the lives. You have to finally use it. And by then, it's late, and you're late to the game, basically, at that same time. And so that's why I was very interested, because you were talking about doing this three-hour training. Is this something that's open for your entire newsroom? Does this AI training, and it's all about specifically on generative AI, or you go more deeper into all of the different aspects of AI as well?
It's a good question. So yeah, it's open to everyone in the newsroom. I am pleased, because it's a very popular training session. So the problem we have right now is having enough time and training budget to train everyone in the newsroom. But we are on an ongoing basis giving this training. So it's not my full-time job. So I'm really trying to free up sometimes for these training sessions. But in 3 months or so, I was able to have training sessions with approximately 100 people, which is not bad for us. And yeah, it's always interesting, because we try to build the groups with people from different background or different teams. So for example, we have usually people from TV, radio, or web, and it gives a lot of interesting conversation and, different perspectives on the task, and they have different daily routines. So I think it's really the best way to enhance our creativity.
What does your course look like? What does the training sessions look like? What do you focus on over there?
It's not only on generative AI, but mostly, I would say. But to begin, we try to have a firm understanding of the different concepts of AI. So, for example, machine learning, deep learning, or generative AI are not the same. And as journalists, we need to be able to differentiate it. We also have several discussions about, for example, what are the training data for LLMs? And in fact, we deconstruct what's AI and to understand that, for example, when you use ChatGPT, what is a transformer, for example? So how does it work? And you know, to understand that it's really a probabilistic calculation of the next word one after another is really a deconstruction of AI at the core of what it is. And it's always a slide where people are like, oh, okay. So, for example, I have, it's a simple example, but we use it in the training class. They have to write, please guess the next word, the sky is. And everyone has a different answer. And they're like, but why? Why don't we have the same answer? And it's a great way to explain that each time you ask ChatGPT or another model a question, it begins to calculate something and it will not give you the same result as the other, your colleague next to you. So it's a good starting point. And then we explain the concept of hallucinations, why it's in fact deeply embedded in the concept of AI and why it's in a way necessary. And we clarify some things, some key concepts. So for example, to understand that an LLM is not a search engine and we shouldn't use it as a search engine. But then we see how to ground an LLM to a database or to the web, a web search tool, for example, etc. And after that, we explore our ethic guidelines for using AI. And the third part, which is maybe my favorite one, is really like prompt engineering, how to improve your results from LLMs, from ChatGPT. And, you know, it's important also for journalists to understand that the training session is on ChatGPT 3.5. And the disclaimer is the training is on, I would say, it's a general public tool. It's not a specialized tool. And a reflection or a thinking we have is it's good for training. But if we want to implement AI in newsrooms, we have to think about really more specialized tools or models. But no, it's another question. It's always interesting to see in 3 hours, we are able to really learn a lot of different things. And at the end, to understand how to talk to the machine. And maybe it's one of the greatest evolution of AI. We are able to talk with machines with our natural language. So we can ask them to execute something. I'm always excited to give this session because there are a lot of fascinating discussions about AI.
Yeah, I really like that. Very similar actually to what I do, is always talking about the basics of understanding, getting a bit deep into the technical side of AI and how it works. And that really helps people then understand also why hallucination happens, like even why does this model work? How does it even work? All it's doing is basically predicting the most likely next word. And it's basically like autocomplete on steroids, if you've ever had that. That's the way, it's just working by predicting the most likely next word. And so based on that, that helps people then understand what are the different use cases they can use. And they realize it's mainly not for generating knowledge, it's for generating language. So as you said, don't use it for Google as a Google search engine. I really like that. And then also focusing on the ethical side of when to use AI and when not to use AI. And finally, I think what you said, prompt engineering, it sounds very technical when we say prompt engineering, but I think it's basically like learning how to talk to machines, right?
And, you know, as a journalist, our specialization is asking the right questions. And it's the same with the machine. How do you talk to it? And you can improve your results so much. And knowing what you can ask and what you should ask and when you shouldn't ask the machine something. So for example, each time your editorial judgment is on site, you shouldn't have an interaction with AI. But when it's for a tedious task, for example, or you know, when you have a specific question, that's perfect. It's a perfect use case. But yeah, it's the prediction on steroid, it's a good image. And the core, it's mathematics. And what are mathematics? It's a representation of the world. So when you then understand that, you can use the magic and being able to really use it in the correct way.
And what are like the example use cases you share with them to get them started with prompt writing? How do they respond to that?
Well, I think one of the most interesting example is I give them a transcript of a press conference of the prime minister talking about energy issues. And, you know, he talks a lot about hydroelectricity, solar wind power. And in fact, a journalist in the press conference asked him, "What about nuclear energy?" And his answer is, "We won't touch that." And it's interesting because it was the first time the prime minister talked about that. And it was the lead of the story this day. But if you ask to ChatGPT, "Hey, give me a summary of the press conference," he will not focus on nuclear energy because the prime minister didn't even tell the word nuclear. It was in the question. And, you know, the weight of the words in the general press conference, hydroelectricity, wind, solar, are really heavier than this just specific word. And it's a great example to explain them, like, sometimes you can't rely on summarization for an important news conference from the prime minister if you haven't heard it, if you haven't exercised your editorial judgment to know what was important for this press conference. But for example, if you need the time code or if you need to just extract some quotes, it's useful. And if you prompt it correctly, so for example, if you tell ChatGPT, "Act as a specialized journalist in energy questions and give me every quote about every kind of energy sources in this press conference," he will tell you, "Oh yes, and he mentioned that the country won't touch nuclear energy." So it's interesting, you know, it allows us to talk about how to correctly talk to the machine and also how to exercise our digital judgment. It's just one example, but I find it really interesting because at the beginning of the session, people are like, "Hey, how can I use it to summarize a PDF?" And sometimes it's okay, but sometimes you're taking a risk. And sometimes, you know, for journalists, it's the needle in a haystack that is interesting and not the whole overview of the document.
Yeah. Wow. That's actually a really great example. I'm actually going to use this example because I think it's a very great exercise in when to use AI and when not, because something like a prime minister's press conference, if you just summarize it, you'll miss the key part of it that became the story, as you said. The needle in the haystack is what we are usually looking at. And that's the human quality, again, exercising that editorial judgment.
Absolutely. Imagine if you miss the lead, it could be awful. So yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so this has been very interesting. You have this like three parts to your training program. And then after that, what does like the follow-up look like? How do you try and see that people are able to use AI and use these kinds of tools? How do they then embed their AI into their workflows?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Well, the first measure of success, I would say, is at the beginning of the training session, ask them, "For you, what is AI in a word or two?" And not everything is black, but I got words like fear, replacement, loss of control. I even had octopus. So this kind of big images of something scary and you know, destabilizing. And at the end, in the end of the session, ask them the same question. And you know, I've divided the whiteboard in two. And I have words like creativity, sense of control, possibility. So we can measure immediately a sense of ownership. And after the training session, a survey is sent to participants. And one thing that really pleases me is that to the question of whether people are able to concretely apply the learning in the training in their work, the score is very, very high. I think it's one of the highest we have for training sessions. So it's a good indication also. And another measurement is, since we began to give this training session, I can sense we have a better understanding of issues surrounding AI, and it gave us a lot of ideas for news stories. And, you know, ideas are the most valuable thing in a newsroom, so it's really important. And another example is this training program also led us to the creation of an internal prompts library. So, in fact, I'm always surprised to see people using ChatGPT or other AI tools on their own when there's real value to be created by pulling prompts, for example. And we need to realize the value of prompts. Think about them together. And, you know, newsrooms need to conceive them as a common tool, I think. So in general, I can see we use it much more in everyday life. So for uses like transcription, but also wider ideas, like, for example, we created the Hallmark movie scenario generator for Christmas based on AI. You know, have examples in mind. For example, a colleague used the text extraction function with the vision in ChatGPT in images to generate Excel files from access to information requests, because I don't know why, but most of the time when we have data from access to information requests, it's always scanned in a way we can't extract the data. But if you just take a picture, send it to ChatGPT, you have a nice Excel sheet and it's easy to use.
So amazing. One of my favorite features, by the way, of ChatGPT.
It's a real-time server. And, you know, we have a different example. For example, one has this reverse idea of generating wrong answers to news quizzes. So I guess because it's drilled to generate the real answers, so use ChatGPT to have the wrong ones. And it's creative. It's funny.
Wow, I love that. So it's like your internal prompt library that you have been organizing. Once people take this course, then you are able to share that knowledge within the team. How do you actually put it together? Like, where is it hosted? How are you able to have people contribute to this?
It's a low-key tool. In fact, it's a Google Sheets, because we at Radio Canada, we have the Google tools, so Gmail, Google Drive, and so on. So it's hosted on an internal website, a Google website, and everybody can interact, add their own prompts, make suggestions, etc. So we can gradually improve them and find new use cases. But I have a feeling that it's not enough to just put this tool somewhere on internet in our internal website. So we are actually building a prompt clinic. And the prompt clinic is the idea of, you know, in fact, it's an idea I've been simmering since the start of the training. And I see it really as a level two, because once the awareness phase is done, we need to explore concrete cases. So we are in the thick of it right now. We approach it not from the angle of employment in general, but rather like all the tasks that constitute our job. So we ask everyone to break down the task of their job and think about which tasks AI could be useful to implement. So we will have a practical session where the goal is to come out with concrete tools. So for example, it could be a prompt, obviously. It could be a program, a Google Collab, a GPT, name it. But we really want to focus on having really specific applications. We don't want it to be just another item on a to-do list, overload developers who don't have the time to work on it. So we really want to do short, concrete iterations, and we will capitalize on that. And, you know, for more structural projects, it's on the side of the digital media department. And by the way, I wish that the developers will participate to the prompt clinic, because, you know, it will just enrich the ideas of everyone and create a culture of collaboration. So it's very important for me. And at the end, again, the goal is to create value. If we each use ChatGPT in a corner, it will remain something artisanal and not very effective. So yeah, I think we can really go much farther by sharing our ideas. The main idea behind that is the best use cases, and I'm convinced about that, will come from people using it in their daily operations.
Yes, absolutely. Those are like the two things I always say about why we need to be doing and focusing on AI literacy in newsrooms right now. First of all, because as you said, the more people have access to this tool, understand it, the more use cases you can come up with. Every single person has a completely different set of ideas, problems that they encounter when they're working. And you can brainstorm about that with the different use cases. And also, as you say, second is we need to be informed citizens about AI, because at the end of the day, we are the ones who are reporting, finding, breaking stories about AI. If we don't understand the technology, how are we going to be reporting effectively on AI and finding stories and misuse of AI and all of these different aspects? So you're really building that into your team over there. That's what I'm getting from here.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're absolutely right about, you know, having the importance of understanding AI, because there is a lot of marketing about it. And you know, it's a real revolution in a sense, but there's also a lot of AI labels where it's not really AI. So we have to be able to differentiate true from, you know, false claims about AI. And it's, yeah, really important.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
So the prompt clinic was something that is a follow-up that you have to your 3-hour training sessions. Now a more practical, hands-on, bringing people to brainstorm use cases and create GPTs or some sort of like small prototype product. That's what you really focus on during the prompt clinic, right?
Yeah. You need to follow the first training session to be able to participate to the prompt clinic, because maybe if you're really a specialist or if you understand AI well, you can assist to the prompt clinic. But I think it's really important to have this common framework of knowing the basics and, you know, having a common vocabulary and approach on prompt engineering. If we start from scratch, if we need to understand how to craft a good prompt, we will lose our time. So it's really a way to, you know, shift gear and digging a little bit deeper into generating concrete use cases for our newsrooms. And I look forward to see what will come out of the opportunity. It's a kind of opportunity identification exercise. And I'm sure they will have a lot of ideas because they already have some ideas. And they don't need to have a well-formed idea. I think the main goal for this prompt clinic is just to identify the task on which they want to work on. And it's the most important thing. If you don't know how to build the tool, that's okay. We will think about it together. But if you just have the idea of, hey, it's a painful point for me, this specific task, and I would like to automate it, or to have an assistant to help me for that, be it, for example, filling access to information request, or extracting data from files or transcription, that kind of thing. We can imagine a lot of different use cases in the newsroom.
I feel like you must be sitting on like a treasure trove of use cases for generative AI pulled across your entire newsroom.
Yeah, and the goal is to unlock it, but I'm convinced that we are sitting on it, and I foresee major possibilities in various fields, and my approach will always be to anchor it in the concrete and daily life of journalists to make them useful tools, and I see several important use cases, for example, content adaptation. We have many platforms to feed. As I said, we have TV, radio stations, we have TikTok accounts, websites, news apps. We have specific formats for, our readers, etc. And our resources are increasingly limited. So if we manage to configure tools well, starting, for example, with a few short prompts, or if necessary, with fine-tuning, we would be able, for example, to generate a web article draft from a TV to text, and it can be a significant gain for journalists. The same for a TikTok script, for example. To adapt a TV story for TikTok could be useful with a well-trained GPT or a carefully crafted prompt. A small example I developed for Newsroom and for my own pleasure was Twitter Threads tool. You can give it an article and ask it to generate a Twitter thread with a number of tweets of your choice in the language of your choice for a specific audience. And the synthesis exercise works well. It always needs to be tailored, but what a time saver. And it's a simple example of content adaptation, which can be pushed further. And once you have the idea and you reiterate on it, it's to be really useful. Another important use case I see is transcription, because for us, the potential is huge. We are based on radio and TV stories. So we are electronic media. So if we can transcribe everything we produce and everything we have produced before, we potentially unlock a torrent of data. And, for example, for indexing, for entity recognition, for internal training, for accessibility, which is an important goal for us as a public media, we can also have a considerable leverage effect with the amounts of video we produce every day. With CBC, I think we are probably the place where the most feeds, shootings, live broadcasts converge in the news media in the country every day. So it's a unique cultural heritage in the country, and it has a major value both for the public and for AI development. And for example, my colleagues are in the archives department, already seeing their work evolve at a great pace daily. There are multiple different examples for example, research and data crossing for digging into tons of data. There are several interesting tools like Google Pinpoint. And I read something this morning, they are adding some AI capabilities to it this week.
Can you share a bit more about that, Google Pinpoint, and have you been using it for research? It's actually an old tool, by the way, Google Pinpoint as well.
That's what I was going to say. Is in my opinion, it's really an undervalued tool because it's so efficient. You can ingest a lot of data in it, be it videos, audio, images, and it can extract text from, it can transcript your video and your audio, it can find text and images, etc. And then it will automatically create tags, index content, so you'll have a search engine for your content. I think you can upload up to 200,000 documents for one collection. So, you know, for investigation purposes, it's really efficient. This week I was talking to colleagues from Radio France, and they have a project with a research institute where as soon as a politician says a number on their in their shows, it automatically fact checks in databases of statistical institute if it's true or not. So, you know, that kind of use case is really interesting. And, you know, for data, another case I tested out of curiosity are the election results. And so we don't necessarily think about it, but for structured data like result tables, it really requires a different AI programming than unstructured data. So I wanted to dig a little deeper on this question, and I developed a tool to probe the results database from natural language queries. And it's quite impressive. It can quickly, really, the cost of prompts could be a little bit high, but the quality of the responses is there. So, you know, I even asked my LinkedIn community to try to break it, and it allowed me to rework some aspects. And so, you know, it's quite iterative. And we could consider uploading the results of the last 10 years or more, and imagine what a useful tool it could be for election night. You can like just ask, hey, who won in this riding 10 years ago? And he will find the answer for you. So imagine this kind of, specific tools really making our life easier. And you know, that's something we really need to think about. And you know, another thing I'm thinking about for use cases is, and maybe I'm projecting a bit into the future, but there's an opportunity to deeply rethink the way the public will interact with information and how we want to present it to them. Because we already see with mobile devices where there are emerging examples of, you know, devices completely rethought and betting on AI. And, you know, there are also conversational possibilities, agents, AI-boosted search engines, that kind of thing, cloning, hyper-personalization. And I think it can change the way of interacting with the web. And without necessarily making current users disappear, it can add to them. And we need to think about this. We need to think about what forms of journalism are we going to present to our public users, and what we will send to the external platforms like search engines or ChatGPT, that kind of thing. It's something we really need to think about it right now, I think.
That's a very interesting point, one that I haven't really thought about or heard about actually much, like a whole different way in which information is catered for your audience versus catering it for search engines or training data per se for all of these models. So maybe like an API or some sort of a database for them, but you're having new and innovative forms for your audience. It's not the same thing going to both places.
Absolutely. Like, do we still focus on writing classical web articles, or do we think of new ways of presenting information and you know, really focus on how will people interact? We will interact with devices, with platforms, and with information. You know, if you can ask an agent to summarize your content. I recently saw a very interesting project I want to try out from LangChain. It's called, I think, GPT Newspaper. And you can just select a different news sources and tell, okay, today I'm interested about federal politics and, you know, environment news and finance. And it will build you a personalized newspaper, but digital newspaper. It's really the starting point of something. And what, how it will evolve and will it be useful? I don't know. But for example, we are able to interact with the ChatGPT with the voice. Will we interact with information with voice? We will see. So, you know, really thinking about the physical or the form we will present information is crucial. And we need to do it right now.
I really think that's such a crucial point that you're bringing up. One thing I keep on looking at all of these tech companies and social media, they adopt a very like product thinking methodology to the way they're building out their products, constantly understanding user behavior, collecting a lot of data on users, and then automatically then modifying their products. And that's how we have come to where we are in the way that social media platforms have taken over the traffic, I would say. And the good things that they're doing over there, we could embody maybe the way they're working on their products and iterating it so quickly and rapidly. Like every time you go onto like any of these social media platforms, you regularly see like a new user feature update goes away from time to time because they're testing out and seeing if users are liking it or not. And I think those kind of qualities we bring towards the way we are creating news experience. That's what you're saying is like let's focus on right now what the future of news looks like. Let's start interviewing people. Let's start testing out and start thinking way ahead because the news experience has to change with AI.
And you're raising, I think, an existential question because as journalists, we only define ourselves as content creators or we just focus on content. And I think newsroom, news organizations need to think about themselves as, yes, content business, but also as tech companies. And it's not natural for us. It's not natural to collaborate with developers. It's not natural to think about machines. And I'm convinced that AI can unlock that kind of thing. We can pretend and we can try to be more technical than we are right now. And it's fundamental, as you said, because it will allow us to think about news experience. We should not stay in our ivory tower and just think about if you build, they will come. It's not the case anymore. And AI will probably have a huge consequences ways news are consumed and on news consumption because devices will change, habits will change, and you know also what people will expect from us. So yeah, it's an important moment to think and you know it raises interesting question about, for example, personalization. Do we want to create an individual news offer for each people? Is it a bad idea? What will we lose in the in this kind of trade-off between, you know, our goal is to inform the general public and have different ideas confronting in the public space, but also what if you as a user want something very specific? It will be a delicate balance to find in these use cases. But again, we need to think ourselves as both content and tech companies. It's crucial, I think.
This whole thing is actually just bringing me back to the interview I had with Jeff Jarvis, where he was talking about if we focus on just content, we will be doomed because GPT, all these large language models are able to produce content at such speed and commoditize it. And also maybe we move news to go back to the conversation. The history of news has always been this conversation that we're having with people. And personalization maybe is the way of seeing it is also having a conversation with your audience, moving from producing mass media for many to producing it at a more individual level. And you're having a conversation with an audience, building that experience. So this has been fascinating, actually, to just go deeper into, to think about where the future of news should be, what should we be focusing on right now.
I love the episode with Jeff Jarvis because, and it's exactly the quote I had in mind. It was the most striking in this episode. It was like, do we focus too much? Or are we just obsessed with content. We need to be obsessed by content. It's our specialization. It's what we do best. But you know, I was talking to Philippe Baudouin. He's an entrepreneur here in Montreal, specialized in AI, and he's a news junkie. He really has a deep care for journalism. But he asked me this question: do you think writing will still be an important added value in journalism in the next few years? And he didn't have the answer, but I was like, hey, you know, it's a tough question, because I think as journalists, words are carefully crafted and it's very important to craft them well. But we also need to open the question of what's the most important thing? Where do we create value for the public? And by value, I mean democratic value, public interest, and that much. But for several new species, you will want to craft your words very carefully. But for other ones, maybe you can have an assistant helping you. I don't say we should publish something created entirely by AI and closing our eyes and hoping everything will be okay. But can we free up some time with a lot of different platforms to feed? Do we need to invest a lot of times in writing and adapting our content? I think it's a conversation we need to have. And probably every newsroom will find a different answer. It all comes down to your internal culture, your values, and it will be also an individual question. What do you expect? What efforts do you put in writing versus speaking to sources and finding unknown information? It's an interesting question, and I don't have the answer. It's an answer we need to find together.
Exactly. I don't think anybody has the answer right now. That's the whole point. I'm doing this actually to try and see if we can come up with an answer together and keep talking about this. But that also brings me actually back to one thing that I wanted to learn more about, was about these AI models. They are predominantly English based. They have been trained. All of these large language models have been trained extensively on English data. So I'm actually quite curious. You're talking about all of these use cases. You're a French newsroom. How do all of these AI models perform in the French language? Is it still as effective, or you have to do everything, communicate with it in English mainly?
It's an interesting question. We've seen a lot of progress, but historically it was a problem. For example, for the transcription of video or audio, models were primarily trained in English and they were therefore useless in French. Then they improved in French, but with the French accent. And with the Quebec accent, for example, the error rate was still high. But then we saw big players like, I think, for example, Amazon was the first to train its models with Quebec speakers, and then it became really usable in production. Today, with models like Whisper from OpenAI, we see little difference. My impression is that it's more related to the model than the training data, but I might be wrong, but it's really the most effective I've tested in several languages, by the way. And it's open source, so you can integrate it in different applications. On the text side, I think it really depends on the models. GPT-4, for example, if my memory is correct, on a 3-shot accuracy benchmark on MMLU, and I would not enter into the details, but it is a benchmark for, you know, evaluating capacities to reason. I think it's something around 85% in English and 93% in French. So, you know, it's not a big difference. And, you know, I've also noticed a certain effectiveness in adapting to Quebec-specific spelling or words, for example, if we specify it to the model.
Like you're telling the model specifically, like a Quebec French.
Yeah. Like, for example, for ChatGPT-4, you tell him, hey, please write with for a French-speaking audience in Quebec. And it will adapt several words. Because, you know, and I was born in France, so I can't tell him, but in France, we use a lot of English words. That's not the case in Quebec. So, you know, it's a kind of cultural difference, and it's always interesting. But that said, yeah, there are real issues about cultural sovereignty. For example, the French startup Mistral, which developed really small, but very efficient models that, by the way, they recently raised, I think, 40, $400 million, and so they're really expanding. And their first model, it was Mistral 7B. It was it had only been trained in English, and I must say I was surprised. But their second model, Mistral 8 Multiple 7B, masters French, Italian, German, and Spanish. And, you know, it scores slightly better on the MMLU benchmark in French than in English. And, you know, it's funny because in Montreal, it's important to note that Montreal is an AI hub, notably with thinkers, researchers like Yoshua Bengio, Joël Pinault. They are among the brightest in the field. Yann Lequin is a French researcher, and it may not translate explicitly in models created, for example, in French, but for us, for the Canada, for journalists, it does immerse us in the ecosystem, and it's a big advantage, I think. And for example, we can frequently hear them on our airwaves, especially Yoshua Bengio. And recently we did a special 2-hour show really about AI. And we had the privilege of having all the three researchers, Yoshua Bengio, Joël Pinault, and Yann Lequin, on the same TV show. So, you know, it's not unique. And I was like, whoa, it's very interesting. And we had so much good feedback from the public. They were like, hey, we understood what AI is. And, you know, my next weekend project is thanks to Yann Lequin. I saw that there is a data set that has just been released called Gallicagram, I think. And it's based on French newspapers with 85 billion words. And I think it's a very good base for fine-tuning models in French. So I will try it, and we'll keep you posted about my my results. I hope they will be good.
Or your LinkedIn posts. So you put all your weekend experiments, I think, on your LinkedIn posts. So that's where listeners can go and translate it to English on LinkedIn and hear more about it. And you've been doing a lot of these experiments because you also have done something for teaching. You also teach journalism, a digital journalism course, and you've been doing experiments over there. How have you been integrating AI?
Yeah, I have this privilege to teach journalism at the University of Montreal, and it deeply changes the way I teach, and for the better, really, because at the beginning, you know, at the beginning of the session, I asked who used ChatGPT, for example, and the vast majority of students raised their hand. They were like, yeah, I'm on a daily basis for writing and that much. So
they were honest.
Yeah, they are honest, and that's a good point. And, you know, it's a sensitive question, for example, for evaluations. So, for example, in this course, I've made it clear with them that they can use it. I encourage them to use it. I teach them how to use ChatGPT. But, you know, I ask them to specify to me how it was useful or not in their work. So we have this kind of, you know, trust contract. I thought about how to implement AI further in teaching, and I have several use cases in mind. So, for example, I teach coding and data visualization, and it's not easy to master data visualization. For example, a library like D3.js. When you're starting from scratch, you're like, oh, it's complicated. And a lot of questions I had in the previous years from students was, should I learn to code? And my answer always was, you should understand the fundamentals. You don't need to be, and probably you're not going to be a great coder, but you really need to understand the basics of languages. But I think with AI, my answer changed a little bit. I think you can interact with machines in a much more natural way. So I guide them through how to interact with the machine to have an output in a specific language. So, for example, make me a bar chart in D3.js with the Canadian population by province, and you will have a decent code that you can use. And looking at the code, you can try to understand the syntax, for example. So it's really interesting. For example, also to brainstorm with myself, you know, my course plan evolves every year. And but, you know, brainstorming with me ends up having its limits. So out of curiosity, I try the question, can you help me write a course plan for a course in digital journalism? And, you know, I had a plan in 8 points, digital skills, distribution strategy, tools, etc. Would I have used it as it is? No, but it made me think about my actual plan and I read it more attentively and it gave me some ideas of, you know, helping me to try to make my course evolve. And this year, I'm especially excited about a weekend project again about, in fact, that pushed a concept I wanted to explore for a long time. It was retrieval augmented generation.
Just a quick explanation on like what retrieval augmented generation is, where you're basically optimizing the output of the large language model by focusing its knowledge on specific content that you provided. So it's not just all of the entire training data that it has been trained on. So you used retrieval augmented generation, or RAG as it's called, to build out your weekend project.
Yeah, I ingested all my course notes in this tool, and you know, I record each class to then transcribe it automatically with Whisper and add it to the robot, and you know, therefore they have this kind of AI assistant. They can ask, students can ask a question, clarify concepts, and from a pedagogical point of view, I learn as much as my students because I solicit their feedback for each response. I log their questions to see how it integrates to the course. And, you know, personally, I had a blast writing it. And now I'm really refining it on a weekly basis. And it's interesting because it's been 8 years since I started this course. And I think it's the most important change in my pedagogical approach with them. It was this AI teaching assistant. So it's just an example, but I think an interesting one.
How does it work? Like, how are the students using it?
They can really ask questions. So for example, the professor talk about SEO concept, how to optimize text for SEO. And so, for example, if they didn't understand quite well the concept of SEO, the assistant will just, you know, dig into the course notes and clarify, explain them this concept. And it has a very, you know, pedagogical tone and this infinite patience with them. So the interactions are really interesting. You can also, for example, we have an exercise for next week where they have to write an article about from a news conference, and they could try, for example, to give this their text to the AI assistants and ask it, is my story correct regarding SEO optimization concept? And the AI tool will try to give an answer. So it's really an experimental project, and I, you know, established with my students that they have to think about it like this way. But there are many, I can see their questions, and mainly since the beginning of the session, it has been about clarifying concepts. And yeah, we'll see where it goes.
I love that you're talking about, because also at the same time, you are able to see the questions that students are asking. And so as a result, you're able to understand if there are certain concepts. If everyone's asking about SEO, maybe you have to talk more about SEO and clarify that concept for them. And if just like a couple of students have questions about SEO, they can get this bot to dig through the notes and explain it and make it simpler for them and to understand. And so that's a really, really effective and great use case that you're talking about for teaching and showing it's also for teaching journalism.
Absolutely. And you're right. I can see, for example, if I have a lot of questions with the bot about a specific concept, maybe it's because I wasn't clear during my course. And so I can think about, oh, maybe I should take a moment to explain again or better this specific concept because 5 different students asked the bot questions about it. So, yeah.
And all that you built, though, was with LangChain. And it's all, you need to be a coder and you need to be technical to be able to create those bots. But also for a lot of the listeners listening, I'm thinking right now with custom GPTs, it's basically able to also take in knowledge and be able to create these specialized bots. So that is a sort of no-code way, in which would be an easier way maybe for people to test out and prototype something like this kind of a bot as well.
You're right. And custom GPTs is a really interesting avenue. I try to create a custom GPT with my nodes. In fact, I tried several options, but for this specific use case, I finally go towards a solution I coded myself with the help of LangChain. And for a specific aspect, the observability one, because there is a tool in LangChain called LangSmith. And LangSmith allows you to really see, to log every question, to log every interaction. And that's what I needed. Without it, maybe the custom GPT would have been a very simple and easy to use solution. It's a no-code solution, as you said, and it's a promising avenue. It's something I use personally because I'm trying to learn Mandarin for 5 years now.
Wow.
Yeah, but I'm trying too. And, you know, I have ingested my textbook to a custom GPT, and so I can practice my Chinese with the GPT, and it's efficient, and my teacher don't see what I'm doing, so it's okay.
I love hearing all these personal use cases that you have all filled in. You've been experimenting so much with AI. You have all of these different use cases. AI is part of your life there.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But, you know, a discouraging example is I tried to clone myself with Hey Jane in Chinese. And I showed it to my teacher, and she was brutally honest. She was like, "Hey, it's far better than you." And I was like, "Oh."
Oh, no. So the AI avatar that spoke Chinese was better than you speaking Chinese, like speaking Mandarin.
Yeah, so it's an humbling moment, but yeah. Yeah. Besides that, yeah, I think AI is really part of my daily routine, you know. LangChain has been a really useful tool for me, absolutely. With LangChain, there is also a prompt hub, that kind of thing. So, you know, it's allowed me to go quite far in the exploration of autonomous agents, for example, which are capable of performing complex tasks. And the chatbot is indeed the result of an agent that manipulates data. But, you know, I think, and I'm really grateful for that, there are a lot of different resources on the web to learn and you know, to develop your expertise in AI. And maybe the most valuable one I'm thinking about is the impressive work done by Andrew Ng at Stanford University.
Love Andrew Ng.
You know, I follow almost all of their short courses. And recently I plunged into the machine learning specialization. And, you know, it was, I think it's approximately 100 hours, and, you know, it allows you to really gain a fine intuition of the theoretical and practical foundation of this discipline. And, you know, the short courses are free, and I must say Andrew Ng is an excellent teacher because he can make you understand quite pointed mathematical concepts with brilliance. And I was like, oh, wow, it's, yeah, it's impressive, really.
Kind of like one of my final questions that I want to wrap up with is to understand your personal journey and hear about that, because you're actually not a coder or developer. You're more on the editorial side. You started off on the editorial side of the newsroom, and how you're talking about a lot of complex technical terms here about using LangSmith and LangChain, and that's all like LLM development technology, being able to code with that. So how did you kind of bring yourself to that level of proficiency and fluency with coding?
Well, I think it comes really from a personal interest, but I've always been interested by technology. You know, my professional journey was mostly on the web, and then on the management of newsroom. And I'm convinced that, you know, if you want to bring innovation into newsrooms, you have to understand both the editorial thinking of journalism, obviously, but also to gain a kind of intimate understanding, you know, or intuition about how technology works, especially with AI. You can have a general understanding and it's really important. But when you start to think about, okay, how can we implement AI in newsrooms, I think you have to know which tools are available, what are they capable of. And again, with a lot of useful resources accessible on the web, it's very easy to learn it. And I must say, I think I have developed a really passion for this question because it raises so many different interesting questions about journalism and technology. And you know, I have a background in data visualization and data analysis, so it really helped me because a lot of AI is based on data. But thanks to courses, online courses, I was able to develop this kind of thing. And you know, it's ironic, but one of the best way I found to being and keeping updated about AI was to build automated newsletter based on ChatGPT to synthesize, I think, around 50 different sources in a news, in a daily newsletter that I receive in my inbox automatically. So every day I have this kind of short resume synthesis of the most important news in AI and also research papers in AI.
So it summarizes all the newsletters that you get. You created a bot on top of that to summarize all of the different newsletters. I love it. I'm going to try that out. I never thought about this.
And you know, I didn't know anything about, for example, AWS or almost nothing. And by just interacting with ChatGPT and asking it to, hey, help me to program this newsletter and then host it on AWS and schedule a cron job and that kind of thing. And, you know, with trial and errors, I was able to create this automated newsletter. So it's an interesting example. Yes, I have a bit of technological interest, but I really think that AI unlocks something for our interaction with machines. And you know, the interesting thing about it, is also that it forces us to question ourselves about what's the most important thing in journalism. Sometimes we tend to define ourselves with creativity or different definitions. And yeah, in some respects, AI is creative. AI is it intelligent? I don't know, in a sense that can accomplish more and more complex tasks. But you know, at the end of the day, what is our singularity and what makes us unique as humans, as journalists? And I think above all, it's curiosity. Because a machine will not spontaneously ask itself a question. And the other thing is editorial judgment. We discussed it before, but I think when there is editorial judgment involved, it will always remain something only and fundamentally human. This kind of philosophical question is really important, and it's, I'm convinced it will just make us evolve in our job, in our profession, in a more in a deeper way.
That is such a great point to kind of wrap up this entire conversation on, that it's basically the innate human qualities of curiosity and editorial judgment is still going to stay true even in the world of journalism, even with AI having a huge part in it. Those are the two main things that actually define us, I would say, as news and as journalists, and what the news industry really focuses on, judging what is finding the stories and being curious and asking the questions. And that leads to knowledge, and that leads to creating knowledge. And that's what we are in the business of. And Florian, this has just been I'm very fascinated by all of the different use cases you've brought about today, and the way you're teaching AI and building the AI literacy within your newsroom, the culture you're building. I'm fascinated by it. Absolutely love it. And also, just the way you're talking about all of these different use cases in which it's embedded within your life, within your teaching, and how you've kind of helped upskill your own self by, with ChatGPT, asking it to teach you how to do tasks and coding tasks that you have never done before. So fascinating. I love it. Absolutely love it. And thank you so much for joining me on the podcast, Florent. This has been a very, very fascinating conversation.
Thank you very much, Nikita. I really enjoyed the conversation. And, you know, I didn't mention a specific use case. It's drawing unicorns for my daughter on a daily basis. And I think maybe it's the most interesting one. So
yes.
But I'm really bad at drawing. So thanks to AI, I can be a better father.
There you go. Also helping you upskill, be able to entertain your daughter.
Why not?
Love it. As you said, it's a creativity machine, and that's what it's helping you do. So.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you, Florent.
Thank you, Nikita. And looking forward to listening to different episodes of this your series. It's always a pleasure to listen to your guests and you.
That was Florent Daudens, the Director of News Gathering and Deployment at Radio Canada. Stay updated with the Newsroom Robots podcast and sign up for our newsletter at newsroomrobots.com. This podcast is made possible thanks to the Harvard Innovation Lab Spark Grant. I'm Nikita Roy, and this is Newsroom Robots.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.